Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, U.S. tariffs to cripple many South African exports. Is a trade war now inevitable? 95 billion rand for Transnet. New government guarantees are sparking debate on reform and the role of the private sector. South Africans ditch credit as tariffs and rates start to bite. And how cyber criminals are increasingly using artificial intelligence. It's Monday, the 4th of August. Overnight, the organization Business Unity South Africa is sounding a loud alarm. U.S. imposed tariffs and rising uncertainty over the future of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, placing thousands of South African jobs and key export sectors at risk. With potential tariffs pushing duties on autos to 55% and agriculture and mining sectors on the edge, BUSA is now urging what it terms a coordinated government, business and sector level response. In that respect, I'm in conversation now with the Chief Executive Officer of BUSA, Kulakani Mate. Kulakani, a very warm welcome to you. And what specific U.S. tariff measures have triggered your urgent call for coordinated action? What do you want to see happen?
Hi, Jeremy, and thank you for the opportunity. Obviously, the announcement of the 30% trade tariffs on South Africa is what triggered our response, in the sense that there was that 90-day sort of suspension of the tariffs. And we saw earlier in July the president of the U.S. Confirming that 30% would be imposed on us. So that certainty, if you like, is what made us to make the call that we need to coordinate our efforts to try our level best as South Africa Inc. to avert what will be a catastrophic development when these tariffs take effect.
Let's talk about that coordinated response in just a moment, but we've mentioned which sectors are most exposed: automotive, agriculture and mining. Obviously, huge job losses looming, but it's not just that, it's also the knock-on effect to other industries as well, is it not?
Absolutely. And what we really mean by a coordinated approach is that, obviously, as the adage goes, governments negotiate trade, but it is business that actually trades. And so in this instance, what we are saying is that our government and business should work closely together on both fronts, i.e. the package that is proposed to the United States, but also on the measures to really respond to the 30% tariffs when they do come into effect, because we know that it will be devastating for certain regions and for certain sectors. And so we need to coordinate how we respond to avert a job bloodbath.
Is there a subtext here that perhaps business and government haven't been working closely enough?
Well, as I've said already, that we accept as business that trade negotiations are the responsibility of government. But now that we know, at least until there is further developments, that these tariffs will be imposed, we are saying that let's work together on putting together a response, but also not give up on the negotiations, because there remains an opportunity to still strike a deal that would help avert the catastrophic events of these tariffs.
Are you not being a little overly optimistic here, Kulakani? Is the die not cast? Is this not a fait accompli already that we've now just got to learn to live within that 30%?
I think we should prepare for that eventuality, but we should not give up, right? The United States is an important trading partner for South Africa. It's the second or third largest trading partner for South Africa, responsible for thousands of jobs. And so we cannot just give up that easily. You are right that it may well be that in the end we are not successful. And that is why we cannot put all our eggs in one basket while we pursue to the fullest extent the negotiation route. We should also look at other alternatives from the market point of view, as well as what interim support measures can be provided to affected companies and sectors.
So in terms of this coordinated response, what progress, if any, has been made? What overtures have been made by your organization to start this ball rolling with perhaps more momentum?
We have always said that we are available and open to work with our government, and have been meeting with government officials from the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. But we think that we need to intensify that and make sure that we work far closely together, because, as I've said, the impact of this will be devastating to the economy.
What about the internal dynamics and fixing them? So political disagreements that exist, contention over land reform, concern over affirmative action, numerous legal actions that have played out. Surely that is informing the US's stance towards tariffs, and that efforts have got to be made internally more than externally.
So, look, we accept that perhaps in what the US is demanding in terms of what it would consider in agreeing a deal with us, there may well be some really difficult issues for South Africa to concede on. But I think as a way of building and showing goodwill, we could start with, you know, the relatively easy parts and then commit to work on the more difficult parts. And so we're not suggesting that you know, South Africa should essentially just roll over and agree to everything. As we negotiate, we need to show good faith where we can and commit to working on the difficult issues that may take a while to resolve.
So what easy parts would Busa suggest you start fixing first in that respect?
Just as an example, I mean, at the heart of this, you know, President Trump talks about, you know, the kind of America First philosophy, and within that, trying to even out the trade balances between the U.S. and all the countries on whom, you know, some sort of trade tariffs have been imposed. So we need to look at, are there lines of products where we can, in fact, adjust our trade tariffs in response to that? Because that will buy us the goodwill to show that we are willing to move from our position while we work on the more difficult issues. And some analysts have, in fact, shown that, and I think it is part of the package that has been put forward, looking at issues such as pork, such as poultry, etc. So we do need to carefully look at every product line and see where we can make some concessions to the United States.
Are you worried that the silence from Washington so far to revised proposals has been deafening?
I do not know that there is silence, because obviously we're not involved in the actual negotiations. That's between our governments. We rely on information that is relayed to our governments, government. And so I do not want to comment on that, because I don't know what was communicated to the U.S. and when.
So you've talked about catastrophic consequences, particularly if the sector mitigation strategies don't succeed. Beyond that, the worry, of course, is that we don't really have a contingency plan for worst case scenarios like widespread job losses in the country. So it illustrates just how important it is to get things moving within the next couple of hours, let alone days.
It does, but as the minister and well, the joint statement by the ministers indicate that the government is looking at what interim support measures can be provided to affected companies and sectors precisely to avoid the job bloodbath that you're referring to. And it is also within that context that we're saying we were able to work with government during COVID to find mechanisms to avoid their job losses and so on. And we want to be part of the solution. So we want to work closely with government, even on this one, to provide information on where we think which sectors we think are going to be most affected and what would be the measures that could help at least prevent or alleviate that.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Kulakane Mate, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Business Unity South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you would have heard that South Africa has approved a massive 94.8, let's call it 95 billion rand in additional government guarantees to bolster Transnet as it continues to struggle with rolling debt, with underinvestment, vandalism and reduced freight volumes. With rail infrastructure vital to the mining and export sectors, private sector participation is again emerging as key to turning the tide. But where do we stand right now as far as that is concerned, and particularly what is Transnet going to do with this guarantee? I'm in conversation today with Mark Evan, who's Energy and Natural Resources Partner at the consulting firm Oliver Wyman. I want to understand the real impact of this move and maybe what comes next. So, Mark, a very warm welcome. And maybe in practical terms, what conditions within Transnet, in your opinion, led government to intervene with a guarantee of this scale? It's the second time round.
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for having me. I think what we need to understand is the importance of logistics for the country. It's absolutely essential that we have an effective logistics network. And because it's the lifeblood of much of our economy. Mining, for example, contributes 8% of our GDP and more than half of our export revenues. And employs, I think, north of 450,000 people directly. But unfortunately, over the last couple of years, since 2018, volumes on our rail network have declined by 30%. And in 2023, we lost more than 50 billion rand in export revenue. So it's absolutely essential that this remains an enabler for our economic growth. And so, yes, the guarantee provided by the government was necessary, and mostly because the funds do not exist internally.
So let's talk about that word enabler then. The composition of this guarantee, what needs to be allocated, in your opinion, to debt servicing? We've also got a ratings decision that needs some mitigation, and perhaps most importantly, better capital investment.
I mean, good question. How the money would be used would be, it needs to restore the infrastructure and needs to, well, service the existing debt of 145 billion, right? But most importantly, you need to restore the existing infrastructure so that you generate confidence for what the network can do and is capable of doing.
So part of its capability is in the promise that it's made. It's got this big recovery or turnaround plan. It talks about restoring freight volume to 250 million tons annually. That's up from 150 in the 23-24 financial year. Is that realistic, do you think?
With the right participation, yes. It is absolutely feasible and realistic. And there's a huge amount of interest from the private sector to support that. And it's in everyone's interest for that to happen.
What does right participation mean, Mark? It's critical that it happens, but there's also a degree of reticence among some of those private sector players. They see the opportunity, I guess. They see the necessity, but something still seems to be holding them back.
I wouldn't say it's holding them back. I mean, there's a huge amount of interest, 160 different private parties responded to the Transnet request for information and expressing this is how they do want to participate. Yes, there's some reticence in that, okay, are the funds going to be well used? But I think it's the model of that participation that will be the defining element. And I think private sector, yes, they want their return. And the return is going to come in twofold if they make investment. One, just simple return on investment, and the other on de-risking their own businesses, their own operations. And there are lots of different ways in which private sector are already participating and will continue to participate.
But in terms of the model that you talk about, there are certain prerequisites, I imagine. One is that they would want legal certainty. They would want a better and more stable tariff regime and perhaps even better procurement reform. That's got to be in place before that that energy is unlocked.
Agreed. And I think there's going to be, it's going to come in different stages. There's already, I mean, let's call it interim participation, where the private sector is taking over certain elements of the network, for example, security and certain elements of maintenance on the ports. And it's, but yes, they absolutely will be seeking the right, I wouldn't say guarantees, but the right sort of model where it is mutually beneficial. And the tariffs can be adjusted based on investment. Full privatization, I don't think, is ever going to happen. But certainly investment of or management of certain corridors and certain lines, there is a huge amount of interest from the private sector to take full responsibility for that.
And if the private sector participation doesn't materialize fully or fails to move the needle, there are negative potential long-term consequences, given at the start of our conversation, you illustrated to me just how important a strong logistics backbone is for this country's economy.
Absolutely, but I don't think there's another solution. This is the single solution for the country, and which is, I mean, it's great that the government or the Department of Transport is now open to this, releasing the network statement in December last year and the subsequent RFI and expecting RFPs to come out to the private sector. It's critical.
Just a quick one then. Do you think that if we're going to get this right, rail operations, as far as Transnet is concerned, need to be split into separate infrastructure and operating entities? I think that idea has been floated already. Do you think that has more currency now?
Most certainly. From a governance point of view, that will work. And what we need is, you know, clear execution responsibility, aligned incentives, and ultimately creating an environment which is investor-friendly. And what you just described would be that.
Mm. Well, no doubt the stakes are very high. Mark Evan, thank you very much indeed. That's an important conversation. Energy and Natural Resources Partner at the consulting firm Oliver Wyman.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africans are borrowing less, even though more than $1.2 trillion in consumer credit is technically available. But with real interest rates over 4%, with inflation eating away at our household budgets, and Donald Trump's new 30% tariffs rattling markets, credit no longer feels like a lifeline for many. It feels like a risk. And I want to discuss that in a little more detail with Dihan Sherman, Process Development and Change Manager at National Debt Advisors. Dihan, welcome back. It's good to talk to you. Let's start with that big headline. Why are South Africans turning away from credit right now? What's behind this?
Because of the uncertainty. So if we see current local as well as international media, there's a lot of uncertainty going around. And it's been like that for, I'd say, the last year or at least the last few months. We're looking at international markets where Donald Trump, like you've mentioned, comes out with his big 30% tariffs. We look at the wars raging in Gaza and in the Ukraine. That causes a lot of uncertainty on a global scale, which affects the local economy. And then we're also looking at our local politics and the fact that every so often the GNU tends to be at risk. due to internal struggles. So we're seeing a lot of uncertainty both in international markets and local markets, and consumers are too afraid to do anything because they're not entirely sure. Are they going to have a job at the end of the month or at the end of the year? Are they willing to take out a home loan and risk having a bond for 20 years, not knowing whether or not they'll be able to afford to pay it back? You know, these are the sort of questions that are on consumers' minds.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, it's a lot more about confidence than affordability.
Definitely. So confidence and affordability tend to be somewhat hand in hand, and I'll explain to you why. So for example, when we see interest rates decline, there's generally speaking a high uptick in mortgage loans and people who want to enter the housing market. But entering the housing market is also an indicator of confidence in the economy. So consumers will only look at taking out the big credit agreements like bonds and vehicles when they're confident in their future and they're confident in the economy. What we're seeing right now is that there's very little confidence because of all these uncertainties. Affordability does play a role. However, it's not as big of a role when we look primarily at the larger debts. When we look at smaller debts like credit cards, personal loans, that's where affordability tends to play in. And affordability does play a role here as well, in that we've seen that we've had high inflation rates and now inflation is dropping. And inflation is a good indicator of consumers spending. Their affordabilities are becoming better because there's a decline in interest rates. However, due to their confidence levels, they're not taking that jump to take out more credit anytime soon.
So, Dihan, South Africans then are being a little bit more judicious about taking on debt, but to what extent are they also being declined by lenders, given that the risk environment is so much more accentuated?
So interestingly enough, we found that credit providers and their habits in terms of granting credit hasn't changed all that much. So their risk profiles have more or less remained the same. And depending on which consumers apply for credit, would depend on whether or not they're willing to take on that risk. However, their approach to granting credit really hasn't changed all that much. They're not granting credit recklessly, or not as recklessly as they did in the past. But we're definitely seeing that their risk profiles have more or less remained the same. It's the fact that consumers are just not taking that extra step to apply for credit.
Let me pivot slightly. Both of us have mentioned Donald Trump's tariffs. I want to know why South African households should really care and how these global trade shocks feed back into my wallet.
So I'm going to give you an example. When Donald Trump cut the US aid to South Africa, how it impacted consumers was more specific to a environment and specifically to an industry. We're looking at the medical industry. So when he cut the US aid, there are a number of consumers that we have under debt review who, you know, lost their jobs, or who had to scale back because now their income had been cut in half. So we're going to see something similar when it comes to the 30% tariffs, because it makes our products more costly to import into America. American companies are more likely to consider other countries and other products that may be cheaper. So that has an effect on the local economy in terms of production, in terms of exports, because now we need to find someone else who's going to purchase our products at the same price. And if they purchase it at a lower price, well, companies then have to reduce staff in order to manage costs.
Dion, what about looking forward? There is an expectation, and again, the jury is out, I will acknowledge that, about more interest rate cuts this year. Do you think that could turn the tide on borrowing demand, or do you think consumers at this point are just too spooked by global instability to respond?
That's a difficult question to answer because it could go either way. Lowering interest rates does help. It definitely helps because it lowers the cost of taking out credit. However, depending on how the future plays out, depends on what consumers are going to do. Whether or not Trump sticks to his 30% tariffs, whether or not he reduces those tariffs or postpones the tariffs again, as he's done in the past, may also play a role in at least the short-term decisions of consumers and whether or not they're willing to take that extra step. We also need to remember, consumers are more aware of the cost of credit now than they've ever been. And we also have to look at how the cost of credit tends to affect their budgets and their back pockets and whether or not they're willing to take that on. So it could go either way.
So finally, then, what best advice would you give to someone thinking of taking on new debt right now? Are there situations where borrowing still makes sense?
So my advice is to firstly avoid rushing into debt. It shouldn't be your first option. It should actually be your last option. You need to understand how you're spending. You need to understand your budgets and the repayment commitment before you even consider taking out debt. Also, reassess your financial goals. You know, if borrowing isn't necessary, then focus on building something else like savings or reducing your existing debt. And stay informed, you know, about economic changes and how it affects yourself, your pocket, how interest rates work. This helps you plan ahead. And finally, seek professional help. If debt becomes overwhelming, organizations like National Debt Advisors can offer guidance and assistance.
Yeah, that's good advice, particularly keeping abreast of economic changes which are coming at us like an express train each and every day. Dion Sherman, thank you very much indeed, Process Development and Change Manager at National Debt Advisors.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South African businesses are under siege, not just from power and water issues, but economic strain. And add to that a new breed of cyber criminals. And they're not working harder, they're working smarter, using AI to scale their attacks, steal credentials, and bypass traditional defenses. I want to talk now to Armand Kruger, who's head of cybersecurity at NEC Exxon, who says the threat is evolving and evolving rapidly. And he suggests that many South African companies are underprepared. So, Armand, a very warm welcome to you. So, just how serious is this threat posed by AI enhanced cyber attacks? Do you think we're behind the curve?
Absolutely. I think this is probably the biggest maturity we've seen in terms of cyber criminals and the tactics they typically utilize. The biggest risk we face is, and I think from a general citizen's perspective, is that we are very unaware of what we do every day in terms of where we log in, accounts we create, credentials we utilize across many platforms. And the problem is we need those platforms as we evolve as a civilization. The problem is because those credentials are everywhere, as soon as attackers get it, they can basically just log into your accounts. And that is when we talk about work smarter, not harder. They typically just log into your account the way you would log into your account. And it's very hard for an entity like an online banking entity to distinguish if it's really you or not you. And that's where a very big problem comes in.
And I would suggest that as a result of that, many South African companies are probably not aware then that attackers are using these tools to mimic behavior.
That's the biggest problem. You go to any location, there's a new loyalty card you need to sign up, there's a new account you need to create, because if you don't create an account, you can't consume that service. And you know, we need to consume that service as part of as we evolve as a civilization. In that process, you create an account, you type in your credentials, you type in confidential information in order to consume that service. And what might happen is that entity down the line might get breached and your credential is actually going on the dark web. And those threat actors are utilizing those credentials to actually log into your account and take over your identity. That is the biggest risk we face today, is that we need to consume these services, but we need to be very, very cyber vigilant and lifestyle vigilant on what cyber criminals are actually utilizing these tools that we utilize to just live normally and how they actually abuse it.
So, Aman, do you think it's a people or a systems problem? And by that I mean, are companies underinvesting in talent, or is the technology gap just becoming too wide?
Big problem we see is the technology is evolving rapidly, but we are struggling to even keep up with the technology. A very good example is if you sign up to an account online, irrespective of the service that you're attempting to consume, there's a lot of security measures you can enable that can help with in terms of resilience. We typically don't utilize it. If from a technology perspective, the capability is there. The question is, are we fully utilizing it to our capability? Also, from a talent perspective, I think there's a very big problem because technology is basically taking over our lives, and the identity is the core and the ecosystem that links everything. And if we look at the general talent shortage, we typically start very traditional 10 years ago of how cybersecurity is, even from a vigilance perspective. And I think a very good approach is potentially, if we look at like the educational system, is they need to start adding cyber vigilance as a course. So people are aware of what technology is out there, how it works together in terms of the ecosystem, and what steps to take, measures you as a citizen can take to help add resilience to that attempts from threat actors.
So let me flip the script then. If that's the case, why are companies or defenders not using AI as effectively as the attackers seem to be?
The biggest problem we've seen with all the assessments we've done is a lot of businesses are very unaware of what tactics modern threat actors utilize these days to actually breach organizations. The investment is there, but typically what we see is 60 to 70% of the majority of the cyber investment, especially in enterprise environments, is very lean towards reactive cybersecurity, which is basically you get an SMS telling you you already crashed into a wall, but you know that. So we need to flip the switch. I think businesses need to understand, executives all the way to CEOs, CFOs need to understand, what do modern threat actors do? How do they actually breach environments? And flip the switch, align the cyber investment with those tactics. That is the best probably way for enterprises to ensure some form of cyber resilience.
So Aman, give me a little bit more on flipping that script then. In your view, are there absolute minimum defenses that every organization should have in place right now in light of these AI-driven threats?
I think if we look at specifically on the identity space, which I think is probably the biggest problem we see, is that if you look at very basic control, everybody's heard of it, everybody knows about it, it's called MFA or multi-factor authentication. We've enabled it. Can it be bypassed? It can, but it adds a very, very good layer of cyber resilience into your stack because the threat actor still needs to bypass that as well. The problem is technology is evolving so much. We want to subscribe and utilize all the tools, but we're not in looking at all the security capabilities that comes with it. So I think for enterprises and businesses, the big things they need to do is also cyber hygiene, but rather start from cyber hygiene before they procure a massive solution that's very reactive based that could potentially be solved through very simple architectural changes or controls can be put in place.
Are these threat actors local, do you think?
There is threat actors local, especially look at identity theft. I think there's quite a lot we've seen local, especially Africa as well. There's quite a lot that is local. The majority of the enterprise attacks you see is typically Russian, Moldovic, or all those countries, but they're not limited. I think the big thing we need to understand is that hackers or cyber adversaries is not limited by geographical boundaries. They operate the way the internet operates. They can be from anywhere in the world. They have one goal and they want to make money. These criminals have become entrepreneurs, and that's how we need to see them.
And I'm assuming that current compliance and regulatory frameworks such as they are already outdated or become outdated very quickly as they are updated.
Extremely outdated. And the big problem we see is every day there's a new form of attack. There's a new tactic that we learn, and compliance just cannot keep up with it. What they're trying to do is build, look more around the framework. So even if attacks evolve or strategies evolve, it still forms part of a structured framework. That is what's being looked at. But compliance is extremely outdated and it's extremely hard to keep up. That is why also a lot of organizations looking at compliance frameworks is also looking at new technology solutions, AI-driven solutions to help actually keep up with how to update compliance aligned to these types of attacks we've seen in the world.
Well, one, Scott, I hope that not all organizations are sleepwalking into a digital crisis. Armand Kruger, thank you very much indeed, Head of Cybersecurity at NEC Exxon. I appreciate your time. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.